I'm Raj.
And I'm Eddie.
And this is Blood Cancer Talks. Blood Cancer Talks is a podcast dedicated to hematologic malignancies, where we bring in content experts who live and breathe a particular disease and focus on the latest advances in biology and clinical management. Please take a moment to rate and review our podcast in whichever app you listen to your podcast in. The contents of this podcast are for educational purposes only and shouldn't be taken as medical advice. Today, we are excited to talk about the recent data presented at the FDA ODAC meeting on overall survival data from two large randomized controlled trials of BCMA CAR T-cell therapy in multiple myeloma, namely the CARTITUDE-4 and the KarMMa-3 trials. We are delighted to be joined by Dr. Sameer Al-Haridi from the University of Arkansas Myeloma Center, who is an expert on all things myeloma and had an amazing thread on Twitter contextualizing the evidence on CAR T in early relapse. Before we start, Sameer, can you tell the audience about yourself and your clinical and research focus?
Thank you, Raj and Eddie, and welcome everybody on the podcast. So I am Sameer Al-Haridi. I'm an assistant professor here at Little Rock at the University of Arkansas. I am under the Division of Hematology Oncology, but I do only myeloma and blood and cell disorders. I'm also a transplanter, so I do cellular therapy myself, along with other bispecifics. So all treatments related to multiple myeloma. My research focus and focus in general is all about patients, to be honest with you. So I like taking care of patients on clinic and in rounds, but I also enjoy clinical trials, drug development, and I focus also on high-risk myeloma and healthcare disparities.
Sounds good. All right, so we'll jump right in. So we'll start with a case, and then we will use that as a springboard to discuss some of the data. So Mr. T is a 68-year-old male with multiple myeloma that was diagnosed roughly 3.5 years ago. He was treated with Dara-VRd induction, followed by a single MEL-200 autotransplant, and then received lenalidomide maintenance, single agent. Now he's relapsing with a rise in M-spike and also has new focal lesions on MRI, so basically clinical relapse. He was RISS stage 2 at diagnosis and has hyperdiploidy and gain 1Q on FISH. He's currently ECOG-1, and the only comorbidity he has is well-controlled hypertension and hyperlipidemia. So to summarize the case, he's len refractory, Dara exposed but not Dara refractory, and now he's relapsing roughly 3 to 3.5 years after an autotransplant. So we'll come back to the case, but with that case in the background, Sameer, can you summarize for us what are the major RCTs that guide treatment of patients at first relapse who are len refractory?
Yeah. I think that's a great question. So when we focus on lenalidomide refractory patients, I usually think about them as collection of trials under, mechanism of action. So there are the CANDOR and ICHEMA trials that actually include carfilzomib-based combinations with an anti-CD38 antibody. So the CANDOR trial, for example, did look into Dara-KD versus KD in patients with relapsed refractory myeloma, 1 to 3 lines of therapy, while the ICHEMA trial looks at IZA-KD versus KD, similar population, 1 to 3 previous lines of therapy. You can notice in both of those trials that overall responses were higher with a triplet-based regimen, and also deeper responses were also higher, so CR or better were also higher. And the progression-free survival was better for both of those trials, and anything between 2.5 to 3 years compared to the doublet regimen, anything between 15 to 20 months. Both of the trials actually did not show any statistically significant overall survival benefit, even with more recent follow-up data published. The other sort of group of trials are the trials that included pomalidomide or Pomalyst with an anti-CD38 antibody. And that is the Apollo trial and the Icaria trial. And both of those have a little bit lower amount of PFS, it's around a year of progression-free survival. The Apollo trial did study Dara-Pom-Dex versus Dex, and the Icaria trial did study Iza-Pom-Dex versus Pom-Dex. And the PFS, as I said, is around a year. Same thing, the overall response rates and deeper responses, CR or better, were better with those triplet regimens, and there were no statistically significant overall survival. Now, the third bucket of trials are the other trials in a way, and there are a few of those, to be honest. There are the Optimism trial, for example, that looked into BVD or pomalidomide, dexamethasone versus dexamethasone. And that showed improvement in PFS of around a few months, actually 11 to probably 7 months. Other trials, including, for example, the recently presented trial in ASH of last year from the Asian Myeloma Group, the AMN trial, for example, that looked into cyclophosphamide dexamethasone versus a PD or pomalidomide dexamethasone. And that showed also around a year of PFS for the triplet compared to a half a year for the doublet. There are other trials, for example, the CASTOR trial that looked into, DARA-VD versus VD, similar kind of concept that the triplet did result in better BFS compared to the doublet. And, least favorite trials, the Boston trial, for example, selinexor, dexamethasone versus dexamethasone showed around 4 months of progression-free survival advantage for the triplet. And the elotuzumab-based triplet also trial that showed improvement in PFS of elo-based regimen, elo-dexamethasone compared to pomalidomide dexamethasone. So, in my personal experience, I don't use much of selinexor or elotuzumab, to be honest with you, for relapse refractory myeloma. So it has to do with many things, probably outside of the scope of our talk, but it has to do with the clinical trial, for example, design, the single agent activity of elotuzumab, side effect profile, many other things that play a role. So I think the focus is likely based on the anti-CD38 based therapies and the newer proteasome inhibitor, which is carfilzomib, along with an alkylator-based therapy like cyclophosphamide. I think those are likely the cornerstones sort of newer treatments, along with the newer, if you call it, IMiD, pomalidomide, in the trials on top of the anti-CD38.
Yeah, one follow-up question I have, Samir, is as we know that there is no randomized trial comparing the triplet of anti-CD38 plus KD versus anti-CD38 plus PD. And based on the, as you mentioned, the median PFS with anti-CD38 plus KD, it's much higher, about 2.5 to 3 years, whereas anti-CD38 plus Pom-Dex was about a year. Again, it's cross-trial comparison and the trials for, had different population. So it's hard to make firm conclusions, but this is a big difference, 1 year versus like almost 3 years. So in a patient who has a good ECOG performance status, no major comorbidities, what is your preferred regimen? Do you typically use an anti-CD38 plus KD or anti-CD38 plus Pom-Dex?
So I do prefer using KD with anti-CD38. One of the reasons that you alluded to is the better PFS that you can see with this triplet-based regimen, and all with the caveat that this is a cross-trial comparison. But we also know from biology that patients who are refractory to lenalidomide, pomalidomide, or Pomalyst does not overcome this resistance for all comers. So we know for a subset of patients who get pomalidomide, they will still don't respond to it as well, just because they're lenalidomide refractory. So I think about it about changing a sort of, a new proteasome inhibitor mechanism of action, which is carfilzomib, that seems to be working better in cases of Velcade resistance or Velcade failure. With the caveat that carfilzomib is not created for everybody as well. Older patients and patients with comorbidities, specifically cardiac comorbidities, may not be the ideal candidate for carfilzomib, but we really got better with dosing of this agent. For example, we give lower doses of it, we give weekly doses of it that may make it more tolerable. So if the patient is in a good shape with no cardiac comorbidities and relatively younger, I tend to choose a carfilzomib-based triplet. Now, the other thing that makes me choose carfilzomib-based triplet is the nature of relapse. If you have somebody with more, aggressive relapse, I tend to use that agent more often compared to Pomalyst, which I tend to use it in sort of older patients with more biochemical relapse or not really more aggressive relapse. Now, as probably many of the audience know, those are different treatment options when it comes to how we administer them. So Pomalyst is something we do orally, and carfilzomib is something we do IV. And I think that has also patient preference and even, other things to play a role there when we make those decisions.
Yeah, I think that's a really helpful comparison to me. My experience with carfilzomib has been less good clinically because of the older patient population, but I think the data in younger patients is very promising. I wanted to move on to chat to you about the recently presented and recently discussed randomized controlled trials comparing BCMA CAR T cell therapy to these sort of physician choice or restricted physician choice regimens, which comprise many of the regimens we've just talked about, but not all of them. Let's talk about CARTITUDE 4 first. For some background, CARTITUDE 4 was a randomized controlled trial in patients with relapsed or refractory myeloma and 1 to 3 prior lines of treatment that compared cilta-cel versus standard of care, which was restricted to daratumumab pomalidomide dex or pomalidomide Velcade dex. In the cilta-cel arm, bridging was allowed with DPD or PVD, the same regimen that was used in the control arm. So can you tell us the top line results of the CARTITUDE 4 study, Samir, and your thoughts about it?
Yeah, sure. This study was presented, in ASCO last year and also published in the New England Journal of Medicine and was based into the discussion we're making with the FDA meeting later, this month. But the CARTITUDE 4 is the phase 3 trial, so included more patients than the initial CARTITUDE 1 trial. More than 400 patients got into that trial, and the primary endpoint was to look into progression-free survival. And progression-free survival did favor the arm of cilta-cel, and it was reported as not reached at the time of the initial report compared to the 12 months or 1 year in the triplet-based standard of care regimen. And that difference was really good, and it made the study meet the endpoint that it has, which is the progression-free survival. Now, a few caveats to that, because the median survival was not reached, some people tried to get a point estimate of PFS. For example, if you look at the 12 months PFS, there was almost three-fourths of patients who got cilta-cel are still progression-free compared to a half of patients who got the standard of care regimen. And the, later on in the newer update of that data, it seems that at least patients who got cilta-cel on, the lower 95 confidence interval, I would say a limit of it is around 2 years, which is really good news that patients who respond are likely responding at least for 2 or more years.
I agree that those data are very promising. One of the sort of million-dollar questions for this trial is trying to understand or trying to explain why the curves, the PFS and OS curves, crossed early on. And so I'm interested to hear what your thoughts are as to why those curves cross.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting discussion we have, many of us in the community, among each other. And I think the way I look at it is this occurred in a randomized controlled trial. So if you look at both arms, they should be similar. So the arms themselves, I don't think about them in a different way. Those are similar patient population who got it, the people who really progressed while taking the bridging therapy and the other patients who did not progress while taking the bridging therapy. The other thing is the bridging therapy was the same as, the control arm. And so it has to do with the characteristic of the trial, because that's the only difference that we have. So CARTITUDE 4, if we go to the design of the trial, there are important differences between the people who got bridging therapy, sorry, standard of care or cilta-cel. And it has to do with the cilta-cel or CAR T cell in general. So for example, if you look at the number of bridging therapy treatments that the patient got on the cilta-cel, on average, there were two cycles. There are some patients who got more, there are some patients who got only one cycle, for example. But there was a rule that patients need to get washout period that is dependent on the type of the drug and the regimen they got. So for example, if I look at the protocol, if it is the daratumumab, they at least need to be off the daratumumab for 3 weeks. So some patients, 3 weeks is the minimum. Some patients may be off it for more than 3 weeks. When it comes to Velcade, bortezomib, it was 2 weeks. And when it comes to Pomalyst or pomalidomide, it was 1 week. So the rule of washout was different according to the agent of the regimen. But there are some patients who got interruption of their triplet-based bridging therapy to allow them to get the washout period to get the CAR T cell. And I think that has this interruption could have played a role why those patients progressed. Because there are some patients who usually cannot tolerate time off therapy. You know, in the clinic, if you they stop the treatment for a short period of time, they have sort of a disease that, you know, cannot wait. They may progress easily. And I think that could be one reason that caused this crossing, along with the fact that manufacturing took longer than the other product, for example, Idacel. So in Ciltacel, if you look at the clinical trial, the report was on average up to 80 days patients waited from time of apheresis to getting the product. And that's quite long. And if you kind of expected to get a product, let's say in a month, and you ask the patient to stop the treatment for washout period, and this kind of pushed again because of any reason, manufacturing failure, other things, then maybe the patient will be remain off therapy for a longer period of time, and that may result in a more progression events.
Yeah, I think one thing that struck me is that because, as you mentioned, the vein-to-vein time was much longer in Ciltacel, you know, compared to, for example, with Idacel. So that's why there is more of window where a patient can potentially relapse if there is a gap, you know, if there is a gap in treatment because of apheresis or washout period. I hope that over time, as Ciltacel manufacturing gets better, that vein-to-vein time will decrease. But we definitely, as you well know, we definitely have patients who progressed during that period and could never get Ciltacel, for example, while drinking. That's an opportunity cost for patients. And that's why in the randomized control trial, you know, it's very important, as they have done, to look at the ITT analysis, whereas in the earlier trial, the phase one and phase two single arm trials, we only looked at the per protocol, but not the ITT analysis. So these patients would not be accounted for in those trials. All right. So given the...
I think before you go on, I think that's a really important point because it speaks to this discussion that everyone's been having recently about the toxicity of CAR T or the potential toxicity of CAR T. And that's not just the toxicity of after it's been delivered, but in the waiting period. And that key difference, and Manny has a lovely paper on this, between intention to treat analyses and as delivered or as received or per protocol analyses in CAR T becomes particularly important. So I just wanted to highlight that point while you were on it before you jump onto the next thing.
Yeah, of course. So given the PFS data was clearly positive here, you know, based on the presentation and the NEJM paper last year, we have been anxiously awaiting the overall survival data from this trial. And based on early OS findings, FDA recently convened an ODAC to discuss some of the concerns about the OS data. So before we dive into the OS data, Eddie, can you tell us what is an ODAC and in what situations does FDA convene an ODAC for a particular drug?
So an ODAC or an Oncologic Drug Advisory Committee, in fact, the FDA has these for all the different specialty areas, but an ODAC is one focusing on oncology products. And really, it's a sort of long-standing FDA mechanism to try and gather expert opinion. And usually the FDA reaches for an advisory committee either when the FDA is unsure or if more commonly when the FDA wants to do something but it's not sure what the support of the community will be. And it's important to realize that the FDA is not actually obliged to follow the decisions of the advisory committee. And another important thing is that at the end of the advisory committee, there's a vote where each participant of the advisory committee is asked to give a reason and then vote on a voting question, and how the question is worded is very important to how that discussion and decision goes. Another important thing to note is that an ODAC is made up of people from all different areas of oncology, radiation oncology, plenty of solid tumor oncologists, as well as a couple of hemalignancy people. But there can be many advantages as well as disadvantages that come from having people who don't necessarily treat the disease that's being discussed, discussing the drug. The FDA tries very hard to minimize conflicts of interest or to be very open about conflicts of interest, which is, I suppose, a positive of the way these are conducted. And another thing that can be both a positive or a negative is that they're conducted publicly. So anyone who's curious after listening to Samir's insights into these ODACs, you can actually go back onto YouTube and watch the full upwards of 6 hours of discussion, which Samir is about to distill for you down into just a few minutes. But if you want to watch the whole thing, that's available publicly. And that public availability is great in one sense because it means it's all open, but it can also mean that there can be some performative aspects to the way the ODAC is conducted. So highly recommended, especially to any trainees, that they watch at least one of these advisory committee meetings because they can be very influential in the life of a drug or life of a treatment in this case.
All right, so now let's jump into the OS data. So, Samir, can you tell us what the top line OS results were at the December 2023 cutoff date that was presented by Janssen in the ODAC meeting?
I think that's a great question. So, to go back to one excellent point you both made is the intention to treat analysis. So this overall survival analysis on December was not intended to do at that time specifically. I think the company was asked to do it for different applications, so they did it. So you want to take it with a salt, grain of salt. So that was not a bland overall survival. But that survival analysis is very promising. It's showing that patients who got cilta-cel, they have better overall survival than patients who got standard of care without reaching the median survival as of yet. And so the data exactly called for around 80% to 2 year overall survival compared to 65% or so in the standard of care. And that's really good. And that may or may not translate to an actual overall survival benefit with longer period of time. So if you look at the intention to treat earlier analysis, the overall survival benefit was not still there. But with this more, I would say, mature analysis, there is a trend towards overall survival. Now, when we have more of the events, the death events occurring in the future, then I think you will get likely the overall survival benefit either in the in the interim analysis that are planned next, or the one after, or the one after. So there are three more interim analysis for overall survival, including the final analysis that is according to the number of events. And that was a very nice slide shown by the FDA in that meeting into the immaturity still of those events. But that's really a great point that with cilta-cel, there is a hope that this earlier use of cilta-cel will or may result in an overall survival benefit. So the PFS you got will translate to overall survival. As you all know, sometimes that is not the case. You get some PFS day improvement with determinant a kind of or worse overall survival. So I think that's quite important to kind of look into.
All right. So there was some concern, though, about the initial crossing of the curves, before we saw that the CAR T of arm, of course, took over. And as you mentioned, at 2 year, definitely it looked significantly better compared to the standard of care arm. But initially, there was a crossing of the curve, and there was more early deaths in the cilta-cel arm compared to the control arm. Can you maybe touch a little bit upon that? We will talk in details about the toxicity later on, but maybe touch a little bit upon that, like how the magnitude of that and why the concern was raised by the FDA.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. So when the progression-free survival curves did cross, I think the biggest question is, why did they cross? Was it only progression events or an actual death event? And what happened is that there are more adverse events for the group who progressed, number one, and more deaths that occurred early on for patients who were randomized to get the cilta-cel. So those deaths could have been related to the adverse events that occurred more often with the cilta-cel group earlier, or to the actual process of CAR T as whole. So there were this crossing is concerning in a way that there are what seems to be increased mortality early on with those sort of CAR T trials in myeloma specifically. That has to do with either the adverse events, that's one of the concerns that we'll discuss hopefully shortly, and or the waiting time and manufacturing time, along with the other things we mentioned about the bridging therapy.
Yeah, and also FDA did bring up another point regarding the later time points of the overall survival curve, that there was heavy censoring in the curves beyond like 1 year, for example. There was the censoring was quite high, so the overall survival is estimated. We don't know what the actuarial will be, but definitely the direction, the way the curves are separating, it looks promising. And also one more thing is that there is no or minimal crossover in the CARTITUDE. Ideally, there should have been crossover because we know that we know that CAR T is active in lateral lines of the therapy. But since there was no or minimal crossover, the overall survival will likely be seen. But time will tell, how these curves mature over time. Eddie, you can take over next on safety.
Yes, I think the crossover point is important, especially when we compare to KarMMa-3, because we've got a bit of a paradox here, which is that in one sense, cilta-cel is being rewarded for not doing the ethical thing, which is ethically they should have included crossover, but there's every chance that would have eroded the potential overall survival benefit. And so we sort of stuck when we're doing this analysis, especially when we compare to KarMMa-3, who did the right thing and included crossover, where there's, as you'll see, there seems to be less of a benefit, that becomes very tricky to balance these two, the two concerns. But yes, let's talk about safety. So Samir, can you tell us about the approximate 100-day non-relapse mortality with cilta-cel and why we think that was occurring, or what the causes of NRM were?
Yeah, so I think that's an extremely important question because, for example, when we do auto transplant, we do talk to the patient about death risk of transplant, an auto transplant, and we estimate that to be less than 1%, or some people call it negligible. Now, there is some size there, but it's really, really a small size. So similar concept, this first 90 or 100-day mortality has to do with the process of CAR-T as a general, and not specifically the actual CAR-T product that's being infused. And if you look at this data, there is actually up to 5% of patients who died early within this 100 days. Most of those were related to treatment-related adverse event. And I think that's important to highlight, because that's almost 4% of the 5%, you know, so that was related to adverse events. So there are some risk into going to actually getting the CAR-T. And now here we're talking about patients who actually got the CAR-T cells. Now, if you talk about the intention to get a CAR-T, the risk of dying was a little bit higher, but that has to do with the progressions that we talked about on top of the side effects. But for patients who actually got the cilta-cel, the risk of death was around 5%. And that's a good large number percentage that we need to be really worried about, and moreover discuss with patients, because this is not negligible compared to the less than 1%, for example, in auto transplant, as many patients with myeloma already got a transplant. So that's a way why we bring this comparison to the table with them. So I think that's extremely important to quantify and to discuss with patients when you plan to do a cilta-cel on them or CAR-T in general.
I had one quick follow-up on this. So one thing that you made a very good point, Samir, that regarding low risk of mortality with autotransplant, one thing that we commonly encounter in the US is many patients don't undergo autotransplant in the upfront setting, right? They might be eligible for autotransplant, but based on the IFM or determination trial, where we know the overall survival so far is not different, they will collect the stem cells and not get transplant upfront. And then when we see them at first relapse, I think it's very important to keep in mind that to offer autotransplant at first relapse, because that's how the trials were done. Unfortunately, that doesn't happen. As we know from epidemiological studies in the US, the autotransplant rate at relapse is even lower. But we know that autotransplant is much safer, less than 1% mortality. And if you combine a very effective salvage regimen like Dara-KD with that autotransplant, if the patient had not received that in the upfront setting, probably will get a really good PFS. So always important to keep in mind, that's always an option at first relapse also.
I think that's an excellent point. And that also has to do with, if you say you have a patient who's transplant eligible, who did not get a transplant, and then you have this question, is it a transplant or CAR-T? I think the safety plays a really important point for patients to make this decision. Less than 1% is way different than 5% or more. And I think I will add one thing to what you said is, the safety profile for transplant is more solid in a way. We really know about the natural history of patients who get a transplant, how they do, have a really very long follow-up on them, the type of malignancies that they may encounter, a sort of the duration of issues they get, like the side effects and all of that. I think we have better understanding because of better experience and longer time using the transplant. So I think you make really an excellent point there.
You actually foreshadowed the next question I wanted to ask you, Samir, which is around the risk of second primary malignancies. Of course, there's been a lot of discussion recently about post-CAR T-cell lymphomas, of which the case presented by the Melbourne group at ASH was from, I think, a cilta-cel patient, and also around secondary AML and MDS. So were there any updates on either the T-cell lymphoma or AML and MDS front from the ODAC?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think it's also something that we're all looking toward kind of understanding better. So the data cutoff for the secondary malignancy was a little bit old. So when you look at the overall survival cutoff point, it was December of 2023. The data for the malignancies was way before that. So what we got to know is that less than 3% of patients who got cilta-cel developed secondary hematological malignancy. So it's also, I would call it around 3%, you know, 2 to 3%. So that's a also an important number to discuss with patients, because the standard care arm did get zero so far. And if we assume that this is related to autotransplant, alkylator, lenalidomide, all of those other things we use, this is a randomized controlled trial. So the patients you have on both groups are quite similar in from that point. So there is a signal there. It's around 3%, 2 to 3%. Now, with longer follow-up, we may see this the same or maybe more with time. So I think that's extremely important. Now, when we people refer to the secondary malignancies, most of us got super worried about the CARTITUDE 1 study, where up to 10% of patients who got cell-to-cell did develop a secondary hematological malignancies, but this with longer follow-up. Now, I would see what will happen with CARTITUDE 4. Now, recently in Blood Journal, there was a really nice paper that looks at all CAR T products with this FDA system where you report adverse events, and they kind of quantify how much reported secondary malignancies were done using that system. Now, this is not to tell you exact percentages first. So we cannot take that to say that this is the amount of incidents that will happen. It's likely an underestimation of what the real thing is. But there was also a sizable number of patients across all CAR T cells, even lymphoma CAR T cells, who develop a secondary malignancies. So could it be related to the actual process of CAR T? I think this is all a learning process for all of us. I don't think it has to do only with one thing. It's likely have to do with the CAR T itself when it comes to the secondary malignancies, because we're seeing this only on the patients who got CAR T cells in this trial, not in the standard care group. So I think that's important. The other thing in that a large analysis, the amount of T cell lymphomas were really low. It's about 0.1% or likely lower. So I don't think that's the major concern we have, is the T-cell lymphomas rather than the actual secondary malignancies like AML, MDS, because it's as bad as it is. When it happens, it's unfortunately a death sentence to patients. And AML secondary to therapy, we don't really have really good therapies for it, same as MDS. And unfortunately, most patients, if not all, will ultimately die because of this secondary malignancy.
I agree entirely, Samir. It's almost like the T-cell lymphomas are kind of a scientific or academic concern, while the therapy-related myeloid neoplasms are a real clinical concern, almost in terms of the way the FDA framed it, but I totally agree with you. So the other thing I want to ask you about under the banner of safety is the risk of neurotoxicity, including cranial neuropathies and also Parkinsonism and movement disorders. Did we get any update on that front at the ODAC?
Yeah, I think that's a really great question, because we get to be worried about some of the neurological toxicities, because one part of it, we don't know what's the natural history of those will be. So in the ODAC, there was actually a nice grading of the and splitting of this neurological symptoms presented. And I would, highlight a few of the ones that we really worry about. For example, if you look at Parkinsonism-like features, and I think that is very important, standard of care patients have 0% there. So it has to do with the class of drug that we got, which is cell-to-cell. Around 14% of patients got some sort of Parkinson-like symptoms. This is all grades. So some of them probably resolved quickly, did not last for long, but up to 2% of patients got grade 3 or more Parkinson-like features. And I think that is a really important number. We don't know if that will be higher or lower with longer follow-up, but we know from some case reports and some limited experience that Parkinsonism could have happened late after getting the CAR T cell product. And sometimes it could have happened also was reported with Ida-cel, the other product. So, but with cell also, I think we need to quite understand the natural history of this Parkinsonism-like feature, especially when we're planning now to use those CAR T cell therapy at earlier line. And I think that becomes more of a more important question compared to the four or more lines of treatment that we got it so far. Now, the other thing we actually learned from real world first, before we're learning it again now with a phase three trial, is the facial nerve palsies in general. And those could have happened with a cell-to-cell. And if they happen, they're usually not permanent, but they require treatment, but they're a little bit scary to patients. When somebody get this facial palsy, even the actual facial palsy that happens idiopathic, patients really get super worried about it. Is it a stroke? Is it, you know, it requires for some patients hospitalization, maybe neurological consultations, imaging, and some sort of treatment. So I think that's extremely important. There are other neurotoxicities that were reported, but most of those neurotoxicities are short-term, they resolve. I think what we worry most about are Parkinsonism specifically, because this is something that we don't know much about it. And we were seeing the signal there that requires really you know, good follow-up for the future.
All right. So yeah, I think that was a really comprehensive overview of the safety. Now we will briefly touch upon the IDACEL data from KarMMa-3, which was in 2 to 4 prior lines of therapy. And for the audience, in this trial, IDACEL was compared with the standard of care regimens. Unlike CARTITUDE-4, KarMMa-3 had more options for standard of care. So it had DPD, ELOPD, KD, and also exazimib Rev-Dex. So yeah, mishmash of many different regimens. So can you tell us some of the key differences in patient population and the study design between KarMMa-3 and CARTITUDE-4, Samir?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, because the question kind of indicated, those are not the same patient population. I think we need to really understand this very well. KarMMa-3 study did include patients with a median lines of prior therapy of 3 lines compared to 2 lines when it comes to CARTITUDE-4. So an extra 1 line of therapy, and that's a big difference when it comes to myeloma. And the other thing is the prior lines of treatments. So for example, if you look at the CARTITUDE-4 data, minimal number of patients got actually an anti-CD38 antibody, not, you know, compared to the KarMMa-3 study, where most patients got it, and more importantly, most patients were refractory to daratumumab, not only got exposed to it, where almost 95% were refractory. And that is important, because when you look at the CARTITUDE-4 study, the bridging therapy that you used, you have better chances of it working, because those patients are more naive or to anti-CD38 compared to the KarMMa-3 study. So that has some implications. The other thing is, even if you look at the pomalidomide refractoriness, there was, you know, lots of difference. Half of the patients on KarMMa-3 got being refractory to pomalidomide, where only 4% are actually refractory to pomalidomide when it comes to CARTITUDE-4. And the last thing, which, you know, Eddie actually nicely discussed, is the crossover and the ethics of crossover in general. The KarMMa-3 study did allow crossover compared to the cell-to-cell. And putting ethics aside, I think also answering the question of early versus late was not done by CARTITUDE-4, because we don't know if giving cell-to-cell later on will result in the same benefit, because CARTITUDE-1 PFS was great. You know, it could be the same if you do it later, for example. And when we come to the crossover, not all patients on KarMMa-3 study who got relapsed did crossover. Around 50% of them. It's a good sizable number, probably compared to the lymphoma, earlier use of CAR T in lymphoma, which resulted in overall survival despite the crossover. I think that's another thing to keep in mind, that if you really have a very powerful agent, and even if you cross over and you use it early, you still can get the overall survival benefit, as we've seen by the lymphoma, some of the lymphoma products, CAR T products. And we didn't see that in myeloma, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. So maybe can you tell us the top line results of the PFS that was presented last year and updates on overall survival that was presented at ODAC of this year from KarMMa-3?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. Now, if you look at the initial, for example, median PFS for initial KarMMa, it was less than a year, around 9 months, 8.8 months. Now, this one is a little bit better, but not too much better. It's around a year of median PFS. But the control arm median progression-free survival was around 4 to 5 months. Compare that to the CARTITUDE, which was 3 times more when it comes to the control arm. So those are different patient population. So the PFS was presented before. It met the primary endpoint. There was a difference. It's not as big as the difference of cell to cell, but again, those are different trials, but that was nice to see. What happened is, when the initial trial was presented, there was the PFS benefit. We're all being happy about that. Well, with the overall survival, maturity was not yet there. You know, there was no signal that there is improvement on overall survival. The curves were crossing early on. So what happened is, we did more follow-up with IDACEL compared to cell. So the maturity of data is way advanced when it compared to cell. And despite this maturity of data, no more, you know, more number of deaths, for example, and all of that, the overall survival benefit was not there. And one of the biggest arguments that the company made is they always misuse this term about crossing over a kind of affect the overall survival in a way that makes it cannot interpret it. And I don't think that's true. It does
Yes,
not
they use the
harm.
term confounding, which is
Harm.
not the
Yeah.
correct term, as you point out.
So confounding does not really happen. And what the FDA did some exercises, statistical exercises to assess this. And the statistical exercises have its own limitations. They call them sensitivity analysis. There are more than one type of those sensitivity analysis. But the bottom line, doing those various sensitivity analysis, there is no suggestion that the crossover is the result of the lack of overall survival. The lack of overall survival is likely related to the fact that this progression-free survival benefit did not translate to an overall survival benefit. And that brings up the question, I could have used ide-cel later on and still get the same benefit of PFS without getting the overall survival benefit. So I think that was the most important piece of information. And as we just discussed, when you have a good product, earlier use should always result in better overall survival because this is what matters more for patients. Now, talking about what matters more for patients, for both ide-cel and cilta-cel, unfortunately, we don't do a good job with collecting patient-reported sort of outcomes and quality of life. So the FDA did make a comment about that the analysis for such important patient-centric kind of measures were not there. And we cannot do it well because of lack of data collection for all patients at all points. And I think that is a missed opportunity when it comes to quality of life. And that leaves us only with overall survival. So I think that's a very important point there.
I did want to ask about something you just mentioned, Samir, sort of in the middle of your answer. You were talking about the maturity of overall survival data. What do you mean when you say maturity, and how does that help inform our understanding of the overall survival?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. Now, when you do a primary endpoint for any study, you have assumptions of differences between, indicating the benefit. Now, overall survival is a secondary endpoint, and it also has assumptions to show the benefit. So if you don't really get enough number of events, which in this case, unfortunately, is death, you cannot tell for sure if, the overall survival difference is real or not. So the maturity of data, or I think the FDA did refer to that as IF or information kind of fraction, was not yet enough for cilta-cel compared to ide-cel. With ide-cel, it's more than enough because there were no good number of deaths occurred, and that's the event that needed for overall survival. So later on, with the interim analysis that is planned for the future with cilta-cel, which is pre-planned, that means this analysis was already in the book before starting the trial, and it will be done after a certain number of events, which are deaths. And there is a third interim analysis for overall survival and a final overall survival. And I'm hopeful that those will read out positive. I think the data is going suggesting that, but we cannot tell for sure without having those pre-planned overall survival analysis.
All right, so basically for ide-cel, the KarMMa-3 overall survival data, we can say that it doesn't really matter whether I use ide-cel earlier or ide-cel later, I get the same overall survival. I'm not sure whether that data will be completely, we can extrapolate that to the CARTITUDE-4 as well, because it looks like the CARTITUDE-4 and longer follow-up might show a statistically significant overall survival benefit. But because there was no crossover, we will never answer that question whether cilta-cel in, let's say, first relapse will give the same overall survival as cilta-cel in later relapse. Maybe to some extent we can extrapolate the ide-cel data, but we will never be sure. But I think that's kind of a missed opportunity there too.
So Samir, having discussed all those super interesting and relevant points, how did the members of the ODAC vote and consider the two different products and two different trials that were presented?
So briefly, they both products got favorable kind of votes, better for cilta-cel than ide-cel. So for cilta-cel, everybody was in favor. When it comes to ide-cel, it was, I think, 8-3. So only three members were not in favor, but it's more than 50% of the members were in favor. Now, and this is quite impressive that you have, 11 of the members thinking that this is the best benefit is towards the benefit when it comes to cell. But also, it's more interesting to see that eight, of the members for ide-cel did believe the same with lack of overall survival in that setting, and with the caveat with ide-cel, which we didn't talk much about, but there was also increased risk of death early on with ide-cel. And that is what caused, I think, the lack of overall survival, if you look at from clinical point of view, because some patients actually died through the process. Some of those deaths were related to adverse events. So I think this is where it comes to make a decision in the clinic. What's better out of those two agents? But when it comes to the ODAC meeting, I think both are in favor. But as Eddie said accurately, that does not mean the FDA will go with this vote. They usually go, but it may or may not be the case. I think because this is a very special scenario here. We have two agents that work on the same target, both targeting BCMA, both approved after four or more lines of therapy, and now both of them are trying to get earlier. So we have a little bit of more flexibility on what we have nowadays compared to what we used to have before. And both of those agents actually did file for an actual traditional approval. So this is not an accelerated approval anymore when it comes to the approval there. So I think the FDA may surprise it, but if I try to guess, probably they will likely approve both of them. But we'll see what they will say.
All right, so circling back to our case, just to refresh the audience, so 68-year-old male with hyperdiploidy and GAIN1Q, no major comorbidities, ECOG-1, and now relapsing clinically with new focal lesions on whole body MRI and relapsing on len maintenance about 3.5 years post-transplant. Let's say that both BCMA CARs are available at first relapse along with all the other regimens that we had discussed. Which regimen, Samir, which regimen would you choose for this patient, or which product which would you choose for this patient?
So I think that's a great question. Now, I think first of all, I would start that those products were never compared together. But also, it's our job as a clinicians to have a judgment, because this is my first and last shot when it comes to CAR T, and I need to choose one expensive thing to do one time and having what the data I got. So the data suggests the following. The median progression-free survival was better in CARTITUDE-1 compared to KarMMa-1 earlier studies. We can know that this is 3 years of PFS compared to less than a year. The phase three trial also suggested the median PFS for earlier use is better in cell-to-cell compared to ide-cel. The early deaths are comparable between both. Both patients have higher risk of early deaths when it comes to CAR T. Manufacturing has issues. One has longer waiting time than the other. So all of that has something that both products share. If I have both products in the same time, both available, and I would say insurance approved both for the same patients, and I can use any, I would likely choose cell-to-cell. The reason why, I just have one shot of that. And I with the data I got as of today, this is what is suggestive that this is more efficacious product, with the caveat that we're doing cross-trial comparison. But I don't think we have better data to suggest that ide-cel will do as well as cell-to-cell. And I don't want to take a risk on my given patient if I have a choice. But one important thing also I will highlight is that the secondary malignancies was something that pushed me earlier to avoid giving cell-to-cell. I'll be honest, in few patients, when I heard 10% and I discussed with few patients, 10% of MDS AML, I have patients canceling their apheresis, saying, I don't want to go with that risk. I'm responding to the bridging therapy, and maybe we have bispecifics, other things coming. So why do I need to take that risk, for example? But now, when you look at the phase three trial, I think both of them have comparable secondary malignancies, around 2-3%. So, ide-cel patients may have maybe more with longer follow-up, cell-to-cell may have more with longer follow-up. I think this will learn it with time, specifically when we offer those patients early on. But everything the same, I would say I would use cell-to-cell. And also I will argue one thing, and I think this is not the focus of our talk today, but we are also lucky in myeloma that we have the bispecific antibodies. We don't have them approved for earlier lines, but four or more. But just to give the listeners some background there, the three approved bispecific antibodies, the overall response rates of them is quite similar to the ide-cel, because ide-cel overall response rate was around 70-75%. Those have 65-70%. But moreover, I think the median progression-free survival there is also higher in some of those bispecifics than ide-cel. So you could have really good patients, better disease control with one of those agents in the future without going to the ide-cel. So with what I got when it comes to CAR T with those products as of today, I think choosing cilta-cel is more reasonable given all of that. And this is an expensive drug. I don't want to get wrong when I choose one of them.
I also wanted to press you a bit more on the same question, but taking into account the very first question we asked you, where we went through all the different trials. Do you think that the data from CARTITUDE-4 is not only convincing that you should choose cilta-cel over ide-cel, but that you should choose cilta-cel over the most effective regimens we talked about, which is CD38 plus carfilzomib? Would you still, even though they weren't necessarily in the control arm of CARTITUDE-4, would you still go with cilta-cel?
I think you're bringing an excellent question. I will not choose cilta-cel for everybody when it comes to 1 to 3 lines of therapy. There is, first of all, patient preference portion. Remember, when we do CAR T-cell, patients will require a significant amount of time away from their house, unless they live across the street. I think that is very important. The other agents, they can get closely with their cancer doctor without really needing to travel. And it all depends on the setting. If you have somebody who's maybe older, maybe having a relapsed myeloma a little bit longer than our case, then you can argue you can do a triplet and get this patient a few years of PFS. Why do you need to put them in the risk of 5% dying out of cilta-cel early on in 100-day? So I would be really cautious, especially with older patients, frail patients. I know that age is only a number when it comes there. But it's also, if you look at commending this across all older patients who are above 75, I think we need to be really careful, because Parkinsonism may be more difficult to manage. I don't know. I think we have lots of unknowns there. But I would take it a case by a case. And for many patients, I may not actually choose to give a CAR T after 1 to 3 lines of therapy. I may prepare them mentally to do that, because a CAR T is a process, and I need to probably introduce it first and say this is something that we may need to do after a while, and we start this regimen, and maybe getting things aligned for a patient, maybe getting approved or contracting, or getting something to make it easy to proceed with should we decide to go that route. But I think that will give me the plenty of time to plan for it. But I think that brings us to one important point I tried to make in that post that Raj mentioned earlier, is the fact that we need not to look at the NCCN guidelines as a minimum and choose until we're out of options, and then go and ask for some help on other regimens. I think those regimens we have there are not created equal. The progression-free survival is not the same. The clinical trial characteristics are really different. And we have those CAR T products are extremely powerful. They work after 4 or more lines of therapy in a patient population that we have nothing to offer at that time. And the earlier studies were really good. So I think it's patients who get the first time of relapse, even if they're transplant non-eligible, I think they deserve a discussion with a place and center close to them that can discuss with them the good and bad things about CAR T-cell therapy, with focusing that there are some issues with CAR T. It's not as safe as we may think of. Autotransplant is safer than CAR T. I think we need to keep that in mind, because there are patients who elect not to do autotransplant because they're worried about the safety. They may do the same when it comes to CAR T, and they say, I don't want to do it, I don't want to take the risk. So I think for your question, I will run it case by case. But the patients I will make likely jump to do CAR T early on after first relapse are a patient who I give them a quad-based regimen with a transplant, and very early on they relapsed on me. And even with, they have high-risk disease, let's say, and they're even having dual maintenance, like a proteasome inhibitor, maybe an immunomodulatory drug, and they relapsed on me early on. I think this is where I would like, okay, I want to likely do a CAR T, because I use those 4 agents of drugs and they don't work as well. So, and that's not a good sign, though maybe I will try to do that sooner than later.
All right. So I think it was a great discussion. Thank you, Samir, for joining us today and distilling the information from the ODAC. And we'll hopefully have you back again to talk about other things, myeloma. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you both.
Thanks so much, Samir.
Well, of course. Thank you.